A little bit about myself. I graduated from Cleveland Marshall in 2004. At the time, I was really interested in trial practice, and that ultimately ended up being what I am doing and still doing. My first job, when I was a law clerk, I clerked for a small plaintiff's med mal firm, really liked the feel of that. My first job out of law school was with an insurance defense firm. There were about 25 lawyers there, so I got to experience the other side of the case. And then I went to work for 2 years at a firm, 12-lawyer plaintiff's personal injury med mal firm downtown. Was there through 2008. And actually what happened in 2008, for those of you that may recall, was when the economy really started taking the downturn. I actually got laid off. I was the youngest lawyer in the firm, last one to be hired, so I was the first one to be let go, and I'm not going to lie to you, that was pretty rough. So I didn't actually plan on starting my own firm. It was something that I kind of fell into. But by the same token, I'm really thrilled that I did. So I've really been on my own. I got laid off in September of 08. Spent about 3 months just sitting around, like many of you are right now, saying, I've got this degree, I've got these loans, what am I going to do? And talked to my wife, and she said, yeah, if you want to try it, give it a shot. And almost 4 years later, I'm happy to say that I'm still running a successful business. Very happy to be on my own, and it's worked out. So that's a little bit about me. In structuring this whole presentation, here's what I wanted to do. I do have a PowerPoint. I am mindful of death by PowerPoint, so I don't want to totally stick to that. And I really kind of want to open it up to all of you, and we can do it however you want. Hopefully when you walked in, you got the sense this was going to be pretty informal, pretty laid back. Really what I like to start out by doing is ask people, do you have any questions for me right off the bat to kind of get going? I certainly have some materials and a presentation prepared, but does anybody have any questions right off the bat that you wanted to ask? All right, that's fine. So we'll go through kind of what I had prepared. That works. There we go. So this is basically what I think are the couple of the 10 or so things that you need to be prepared for. Oh, and the only other thing that I wanted to ask, as we're going along, if you have questions, frankly, it's going to make it more fun for me, hopefully more beneficial for you. If you got questions, seriously, don't hesitate to just pop up your hand and we can talk about something there. By the same token, if you want to jot a question down and ask it at the end, we can go that route as well. So this is basically the agenda for the evening. Wanted to talk about the prerequisites, which is basically what's the baseline level you need to get a firm or an office off the ground. How are you going to get clients? How to network? What are you going to do in terms of office space? Jennifer mentioned the solo incubator project that the dean has just started. I've been fortunate enough to sit in a couple of meetings with him. It's a really cool thing that he's starting to do, that the school is starting to do. I think it's, first of all, a huge opportunity for people like you. And I also think it's going to do a lot to put Cleveland Marshall on the map nationally in terms of supporting solos and supporting students. So talk about office space, talk about some tools of the trade, the nuts and bolts, phone, email, internet, all that kind of stuff, computers, money, more about money, legal research, insurance, and business planning. So that's kind of the outline for the evening. Questions so far? You're all used to the Socratic method where I have to ask questions. I don't know how I feel about that. All right, so the prerequisites. And one thing that I think when we talk about something like this, we forget. When you're in law school, you pick up your huge tort book and you read something and it's really interesting and you learn about it and you talk about it and you argue with one another and say, well, no, I'm right, or no, he's right. And that's all well and good, and frankly, it can be a lot of fun. Never forget, once you graduate, once you get that bar card, when people come to you, they come to you seeking your advice, they seek your counsel, they seek your wisdom, they are seeking your legal opinion on stuff that is going to have a very, very real impact for them. It could be their freedom, it could be their business, it could be their financial health. It could be any number of very real, very large consequential things in their lives. So never forget when you're practicing law that you absolutely have an ethical obligation to your client. If you take a look at the ethical rules, you actually, there's just a fairly minimum baseline of experience that you need to have. And for those of you that forgot this one or haven't gotten there yet, it's set out in Rule 1.1 of the Ohio Rules of Ethics. And they basically say that you only have to have a general level of competence. You don't need to be a specialist. You don't need to have all this information. And so don't be afraid. I guess that's one of the things that I want to emphasize tonight is once you graduate from law school and once you pass the bar, you can go out and represent people, being, of course, mindful that you do have these ethical obligations to your client. The couple things that you want to bear in mind, there's a couple ways you can do it. If when I originally gave this presentation, it was to people who had been in practice for a little while. So if you have a background in something, I know some of you have maybe a tax background or a business background. If you have that background or maybe you've been practicing as a clerk somewhere, you might have a leg up on some areas of practice. You can certainly continue practicing there. By the same token, if it's an area that you're new to and you want to develop a new line of business, you have a couple of choices. You can devote additional time to learning that new area, perfectly acceptable under the ethical rules, or you can co-counsel with somebody. And that brings me to another thing that I think is very important. You inevitably will have questions. I've been practicing for almost 8 years. I still have questions. So it is very, very important to develop a network. That starts in law school when you're getting to know friends, getting to know colleagues, getting to know other law students. But it also continues through your professional development. Go to CLEs, go to bar association functions. I know next month, Cleveland State, Cleveland Marshall is putting on a mocktail reception, and I might be mispronouncing it or mislabeling it, but it's gonna be November 8th. I don't know, it sounds kind of silly, but in all seriousness, I would go. Members of the Board of Trustees of the Alumni Association are going to be there. They've invited some practitioners. That's just one opportunity to get your name out, to start talking to people in the legal field. So that's one place to start. The reason I think that's important, when you're starting that practice, you're going to have questions. You need to have people you can go and talk to. And I keep looking at your book. There's only so much that you can learn from the books. There's only so much that you can find on Lexis. There's going to come a time when you're going to have a question. How do I file this form? Where do I find this particular rule of practice for this particular court? And if you can talk to an experienced practitioner who's done it 25 times, it's going to save you a ton of time, a ton of headache, a ton of frustration. And I see Tom shaking his head because I know that he knows what I'm talking about. So my point there is, one, be aware that you do have ethical obligations to your client, and your decisions and your actions do have a very real impact on them. And two, remember to go out and talk to people so that you can get those questions answered. So that pretty much takes us through the prerequisites. And I think once you have done some soul searching, once you've thought about how you can answer those questions, once you feel comfortable that you can provide an adequate level of representation to whatever client you might potentially be representing, I think at that point you're ready to take the next step, and that is finding people who will pay you to do this. So we've got a couple questions we want to answer. Before you start your firm, you got to ask yourself, it's great to have all this knowledge, it's great to have all this skill, but you need to have somebody who's going to pay your bills. Those are your clients. So where are you going to get them from? When you're thinking about that, think about what kind of case you want to handle. Talking to a couple people that walked into the room, some people were really interested in tax issues. Other people were interested in business issues. Some others were interested in criminal defense or being a prosecutor. And a lot of people just didn't really know what they wanted to do. And all of that is okay. I'm not going to say that one area of practice is better than another, because there's a need for all of it. But give some thought to what type of case you want to handle. When you're thinking about it, Do you want to do criminal defense? Do you want to do personal injury? Do you like being in a courtroom, or does standing up in front of a group of 25 people scare the heck out of you? So give some thought to that, and what types of clientele are going to make you happy, make you satisfied. So start there. there's an element when you're on your own of just taking the first thing that comes in the door. You want that phone to ring, phone rings, client is there. It's something that you don't have any idea how to do, but they're there, they're on the line, they're potentially gonna pay you, so you might be inclined to just take that. That's great for your first month, your first 6 months. But if you do that too many times, you're gonna be spread too thin, and you're gonna end up practicing in 10 different practice areas, and you're never really gonna know anyone real well. I bring this up because you want to give some thought to the kinds of cases you ask for. How do you do that? You do it a couple ways. First, the types of cases you ask for. When you're out meeting people like this, or you're at that social event on November 8th that you're all gonna go to, right? Talk to people about, well, this is the type of lawyer that I am. I'm a criminal defense lawyer, or I'm a personal injury lawyer, or I'm a tax lawyer. That way, when you meet somebody, they know, oh, hey, if I get a call from somebody, this is somebody to send them to. So give yourself, and take some time, practice your elevator speech. This is who I am, this is where I work, this is what I want, what I do. There are seminars and hours of types of presentations like this have been devoted to practicing the elevator speech, but really give some thought. Distill into 30 seconds, this is who I am, this is the kind of person that you should send to me. Also want to give some thought to a website, which what you put out on that website is kind of what you're going to be drawing towards you. So really give some thought to what type of case, what type of client do you want to represent. And I would recommend, like I said earlier, focusing your practice really on just a handful of particular practice areas. Abraham Lincoln probably could have done it 100 years ago, but today the law is just way too complicated. You cannot know everything about every area of law. You just can't do it, and you can't keep current. So what I have been told, and what I do, and what I have found to be a good practice, is particularly as a solo, you need to have a diverse practice. Some months you're gonna be getting a ton of estate planning, but no criminal defense. Other months, you're gonna be getting a ton of criminal defense, but nobody's calling you for estate work. So you wanna be diverse enough that you're keeping money coming in the door from different types of cases. But by the same token, you don't wanna be spread so thin that you can't keep up. So what I recommend is limit yourself to no more than 5 practice areas. And ideally, those should be practice areas that have some cross-pollination. Here's an example. I worked at a plaintiff's personal injury law firm. Those lawyers got an inordinate amount of their business from workers' compensation cases. How'd that work? Somebody gets hurt at work, call a lawyer, they've got a comp case, it's an injury case. Maybe that person is gonna get in a car accident, maybe they're gonna get hurt somewhere else. Well, now they've got a personal injury claim. So that one client, now you've got 2 cases, 2 different ways of getting paid. By the same token, if you're a trial lawyer, you like being in court, you like standing up in front of people, one way to do that is criminal defense. A complement to that, where you're using the same skill set, i.e. standing up in front of people arguing a case, is civil litigation. You could use that to do personal injury work, you could branch out into business litigation, but there's your complement where you're using the same skill set of how to relate to a jury in a criminal context, also in a civil context. A lot of people will do, from a transactional standpoint, I'm talking to you because we talked about some business, maybe you're doing some real estate transactional work, and from there you can kind of pull in some estate planning, and maybe you do some business formation. Maybe you're not doing business litigation, but you're doing business formation. Again, they're all transactional skills. There's going to be some crossover with tax implications, things like that. And so again, my point there is simply this. As you're thinking about the finite 3 to 5 areas of practice that you want to focus on, make sure that we try and get them such that they complement one another. Divorce is another one. You get a lot of calls for divorce, domestic relations issues, and from there you've got child custody issues, you might have some tax implications, so you could get into some business, maybe some smaller business pieces. But I think you get the point. You want them to be complementary. It's difficult if you've got 2 vastly different types of practices. It's difficult to make that run all at once.
Nathan, did you find that there was a concentration of a certain type of case when you first started your practice, like you were getting a ton of calls for criminal defense because we certainly don't have enough of those lawyers, but I mean, did you find that you were getting a bunch of one type of call in the beginning?
That's a good question. I personally did. I got a lot of personal injury calls. The reason, and I still get a lot of personal injury calls, I think the reason for that is I had spent 3 years practicing as a personal injury lawyer. People who knew me in my, you know, through my networking, that's what people knew me as. So that's where I started. That was really the focus that I started from. So I had spent, you know, 3.5 years going to CLEs, talking about how to talk to juries, what do you do on Medicare and Medicaid lien issues, those types of things. So I had that background. That's what people knew. By the same token, I knew how to litigate a case. So what I was able to do was take the experience that I had. I mean, litigating a civil case is pretty much the same. There's a complaint, there's an answer, you do some discovery, you take some depositions, maybe you settle it, maybe you don't, then you go to trial. I don't care if it's a car accident case or a pretty complex business case, the steps are more or less gonna be the same. So what I was able to do was take that focus or that core of personal injury litigation, was able to bring in some business litigation, which was great, branch off into a little bit of criminal defense, and so there you've got my focus, which is basically litigation, starting from the personal injury litigation and then moving into the business and the criminal defense litigation. So I did talk a little bit about your website. The website is, first of all, I think it's very important. If for no other reason, think about yourselves and what you do. If you're hiring an accountant, if you're looking for somewhere to go to dinner, and I see, you know, we've all got our smartphones, I just check the internet. You should at least have some presence on the internet. You can design your website yourself, you can have a friend do it, or you can hire a professional to do it, and there's different costs associated with all of that. I would caution you, if you're going to do it yourself, be careful. Make sure that you know what you're doing, because that is potentially going to be someone's very first impression of you as a lawyer. You want that impression to be a professional one. You want it to be a good one. You want it to be something that's going to make them pick up the phone and say, I want to hire this man or this woman as my lawyer. So when you're putting that website together, you know, give some thought, and you got to be honest with yourself. Am I the kind of person that has the background, the skill set to put together a good website? If I'm not, I should find somebody who can. You can do kind of a trade where maybe you give somebody some free legal services, or not free legal service, you give somebody some legal service in exchange for them developing their website. But frankly, there's people out there who can design websites, really good quality websites, for not a whole lot of money. My candid advice to you would be to just pay them to do it, because you're going to get a much higher quality product. You're not going to have to put as much time into doing it, and I think you're going to be happier with the results. Unless you're somebody who has a computer programming background, and it's absolutely something you can do. In terms of websites, like I said, there's all different kinds of price points. There's the do-it-yourself, which is really not going to cost you anything. And then you've got the Fine Laws and the Lexuses and people like that out there who are going to charge you $15,000 or more just to do your website. As a solo, you're probably not going to have $15,000 in the bank to shell out on a website. So adjust your expectations accordingly. In terms of the website, first of all, I think it's important to have one because it gives you credibility. Second, be clear in your own mind about what you want the website to do. In my opinion, there's two different kinds of websites. One is just the brochure that you put up there, and it's for the if you look at my business card, my website is on there. If you want to know more about me, you can type in my website, you can go to my website, you can learn about my practice, you can check out my blog, all that stuff. And mine is pretty much a brochure. It doesn't drive a ton of traffic to the site. And that's one thing, as you get into this web marketing piece of it, you'll need to give some thought to. The brochure is kind of your minimum, and that's just people, it gives you the credibility. People can go there, they can check it out, see your professional picture, that's another thing. Don't do the in the living room that your wife or significant other took. Get a real professional headshot, they're like $50, it's worth it. Have the headshot, but it's gonna give you that credibility. The other kind of website costs a lot more, but it's going to be search engine optimized. When people type in personal injury lawyer Cleveland, Ohio, Elkin pops up. Okay, they spend a lot of money to be the first website that pops up, and that's driving traffic to them. The other thing you'll learn in terms of websites, different practice areas are a lot more expensive than others. Elk in the personal injury and med mal arena has pretty much cornered the market, and to break into that, lots and lots of money. Criminal defense is probably not as competitive in terms of internet search marketability. Domestic relations, I think, is relatively wide open. But as you start to talk to some of these web marketing people and search engine optimization people, these are some of the issues you're gonna come up. So again, it all kind of circles back. What kind of case do you want to get? How are you going to get it? So give some thought to the website and what you want the website to do. Questions yet?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. So still within the umbrella of where you're going to get clients from, the second, and I would argue the best way to do it is just good old-fashioned face-to-face, shaking hands, kissing babies, hi, how you doing, networking. You can do that at bar associations. The bar association, I think it's kind of counterintuitive. Theoretically, other lawyers are your competition, right? But, as I talked about before, there are so many different areas of the law that there's no way that I, as one person, can cover them all. So you can actually, I found that you can actually get more business from other lawyers, and there's kind of a reciprocity there. You want to do it with your friends, but if you get a call for something that you just flat out don't handle, find a colleague who does, and then when you get that call, you can send it to them with the hope that if they get the call, they're going to send something similar to you. So bar association networking, kind of counterintuitively, can actually be very effective and very, I won't say lucrative, but you can develop a real nice rapport that way. Another place to look is non-lawyer networking groups. Again, just by way of example, what I did, I joined my local chamber of commerce. Bunch of small business owners got me in front of them. Some of them need some pretty basic legal services and might be preparing a will. I got to know a lot of financial planners. They're dealing with people who are planning their estate. What does that sound like? Estate planning, you probably took a class in that. So you get to know people who do that kind of work, and all of a sudden when they've got somebody sitting in their office that needs a will, they can send them to you. It's gonna be different for everybody. I'm telling you what I've done, and it's worked for me. Chamber of Commerce was one. Give some thought to your hobbies. What are the types of things that you like to do? Get out there and let people know who you are, what you do, that yeah, you're looking for new cases. I just opened up my firm. This is what I'm looking to do. If you know anybody that I can help out, by all means, send them my way. People do have a lot of respect for you when you walk in a suit and say, I'm a lawyer. I was sitting in a meeting with somebody a couple years ago. We were actually working with high school kids, and this friend of mine commented, she said, watch the students when they walk in and you tell them what you do. And she was kind of right. Their faces were just like, oh, you're a lawyer? And you really will, you'll get that. When you're networking out with non-lawyers and you say, oh, I'm a lawyer, there's some amount of just instant respect that comes with that, and it's nice. My point is, if you're the only one or one of a couple lawyers, that's great, because when people have whatever legal question they might have, who are they gonna go to? You. So think about, what do you like to do? It should be something fun. It should be something that you enjoy doing. It should be people you enjoy talking to, but spend some time getting to know them. Maybe you're a boater, maybe you're a singer, maybe you love theater. Do those things, but view them as networking opportunities. Another one is your classmates. As you're starting your firm, this is again something that I did, printed up a little postcard, sent it out to all the people that I knew, my classmates, people that I used to work with, people that I had met through, bar association functions, just to let them know, hey, I just started my own firm. This is where I am. This is what I'm looking for. This is what I like to do. And it just tells people, puts you out there on the map, say, hey, this is who I am. If you know anybody, send them my way. You can do that with your classmates. I know a lot of you, as we were walking in, I asked if you, did you just start law school? Did you have a career before law school? Think about other people you know, whether it was from clerking at the prosecutor's office, whether it was from working, you know, in whatever business you might have worked for. People that you've met informally through your hobbies. If you've got a spouse or a significant other, I get calls from people that my wife knows. It's phenomenal. She's like my best marketing piece is the church choir. It's great. But talk to all those people, your colleagues, your classmates, things that you do for fun. Those are all potential sources of business. I would caution you, you don't want to be too heavy-handed. You don't want to be the guy that's always out there looking for business. Particularly as a lawyer, we've got, you know, certain restrictions on how we solicit clients and things like that. Always want to be professional, but just like I did, hand out your business card. Hey, this is who I am. This is what I do. And that can be a nice way to develop a line of business. And then last, print advertising. Believe it or not, even with the advent of the internet and everything that goes there, I think print advertising can still work to a certain degree. Not necessarily that you want to take out a huge ad in the plain dealer, but give some thought to that. If you're in, my office is in Beechwood, if you're in Beechwood, there are certain local publications where it doesn't cost a lot of money to get some ad space, but again, it's just going to put your name out there in terms of who you are and what you're doing. Which kind of brings me to my next point, office space. There are really three ways you can do it. You can do the traditional brick and mortar law office, like we've all seen and all. When you think of a lawyer, that's what you think of. That's what I did. I have an actual office that I drive into every day. It's a nice office, I like it. The solo incubator space that Cleveland Marshall is talking about putting together is a great opportunity to do something like that. Here's why I decided to go the brick and mortar route. I thought about working from my home, but I knew that I just wasn't going to be able to concentrate enough. Another consideration is when you have that client, where are you going to meet them? Do you want to meet them in a coffee shop with 20 different people around, which arguably waives any attorney-client privilege? Not such a good idea, although a lot of people do it. But give some thought to where you want to meet. I went the brick and mortar route because one, I wanted to have a place that I go to work. I wanted to have a desk. I wanted to be able to leave my files out and just have that be my space. That was my personal choice. The thing that I like about it is I when somebody calls, I can say, yeah, come and meet me at my office, sit down at my desk, we can talk about your case. That's the route that I went. Another thing that you can think about doing, and a lot of people, are you in with other lawyers, Tom?
Yeah.
Yeah. What other people, and what Tom did, is he found a group of, I don't know, five or six other lawyers, whatever it is, and they're not a formal partnership. They all have their own individual offices. They all have their own separate business entity. And I don't know about Tom's particular situation, but you can share services. So you can split the cost of the copier. You can split the cost of the secretary. All of those little ancillary things that make your life easier. Now you don't have to pay for health insurance and $30,000 or $35,000 a year for a secretary or whatever it might be. You can split those costs with a bunch of other lawyers without necessarily having to go into business with them. That's one route that you can go on the traditional brick and mortar office that is still pretty cost effective. Kind of the middle ground is the virtual office. There's one, like I said, my office is in Beechwood. There's one right behind P.F. Chang's on Center Ridge River, on Chagrin Boulevard. I don't remember the name of it, and I'm not advertising for anybody. But it's a virtual office. So basically, you go in, and you've got a monthly contract. Maybe it's $150, $200 a month, and they give you 8 to 10 hours or whatever it is of conference room use. So in that situation, they've got a receptionist. They're answering the phone. You know, the Wills Law Firm, how can I help you? You're paying them to do that, and then they transfer the call wherever you want it to go. It can go to your home, it can go to your cell, it can go to whatever number you want it to go to. So to the client calling, it seems like a big law firm with a secretary or a receptionist answering the phone, but you're doing it at a reduced cost in that you're not actually paying for the space. And then when you want to meet with the client, you call the virtual office suite and you say, hey, I need a conference room for an hour. You go in, you sign your check, you sign your will, whatever it is. And so from the client's perspective, that's your office. That's kind of a middle ground is the virtual office route. And then the third way that you can do it, and I'm sorry, typically when you would do the virtual office, you would actually work out of your home. That's where you keep your files, that's where you do most of your stuff. But when you have to meet somebody, you go to that off-site location. That's the location that you would have printed on your business cards, those types of things. And like I said, the last one would be working strictly from home. Lots of people do it. I'm not going to say that there's anything wrong with it, but again, from my perspective, it was not the route that I wanted to go. The couple things that I perceive as being problematic about a strictly home office, first of all, are there going to be distractions? If you're really into ESPN, are you going to want to turn on the sports channel when you should be working on that brief? Number two, if you've got a family, it's not just you, is all your information really going to be confidential? And that's something that you need to be concerned about. If you've got papers lying out, if you've got files that anybody can walk in and look at, certainly we trust, I hope we trust the people that we live with. Your kid could come in and spill juice on something that you need to file tomorrow. I mean, anything could happen. So there's a little bit more risk about strictly being at home. And then the last concern that I had about strictly working from a home office, again, is where do you meet people? Do you want to meet them at the Starbucks or the corner bar, whatever it might be? Is that really the image that you want to present? Do you really want to meet them at home? If you're doing criminal defense work, do you really want all of your clients who are potentially facing criminal charges knowing where you live? That wasn't something that I was comfortable with. Everybody has to make those decisions for themselves, but I believe those are some of the considerations that you should at least go through. And that's really what I wanted to do tonight is not say this is the way you have to do it, but just to get each of you thinking, if I want to do this, what are some of the questions that I need to answer? So that kind of covers the office space issue. Question, yes?
Can you give them some sense of ranges of office rent?
Sure.
What they should expect going in?
Obviously if you're at home, you don't have to pay for it. The virtual office, I want to say, is in the $200 a month range. And again, that's going to vary depending on how much you want. What do you want in terms of a secretary? How much time are you going to be there? And then if you're actually going into an office, again, that also is going to depend on how much service are you getting. And you really have to look around. I wouldn't, go to the first place, or I wouldn't sign on to the first place that you go. You're probably talking 400 on the low end up to, the sky's the limit. But if you can find something in the $400 to $600 range, I think you'd be that would be a good deal. Think about, I don't know if any of you have looked at commercial real estate. Most of it's done in price per square foot. So you kind of get an idea of, per square foot, how many square feet am I getting and what's the price point. Go and actually visit them. Is it a place that you want to go every day? Do you like the way it looks? Are you going to feel comfortable having your clients come in there, sitting down with you? And certainly the more amenities, the price is going to go up. If you've got a copier included, you can be charged for that. If you're splitting the cost of a secretary, that's going to increase the costs. So really, you can start relatively inexpensively, and of course the sky is the limit. And I think that the incubator project that Cleveland Marshall is starting to put together, my understanding is that it's designed to be very cost effective. And certainly I don't think anybody who is going to want to do it, they're not going to take anybody. There's going to be an application process. But if you're serious about starting your own firm, that would certainly be a good place to start once that gets up, if it's not, if you haven't already started your practice. Tools of the trade. Phone, email, we actually still send letters. I think we're one of the few professions that still does. And believe it, have any of you seen a fax machine? A fax machine. But people still use it. These are the things that you need. I think the phone is paramount. People need to be able to get a hold of you. I know lots of people that run basically their whole practice off of their cell phone. That is their phone. If that's something that you're comfortable doing, more power to you. But you absolutely need to have a phone with voicemail so that when that client needs to call you, they can get a hold of you. Again, the caution that I would give you there, certain clients are a little bit more high maintenance than others. Domestic relations clients come to mind. A former colleague of mine was married to a lawyer who did domestic relations, and she told me stories about getting calls on her husband's cell phone at 2 a.m. She was not a fan of that. So again, be careful about who you give your cell phone out to. Do you want to give it out? Do you not want to give it out? Again, you'll see on my business card, I put my cell phone number on there. I'm not going to answer your call at 2 a.m. Just not going to do it. Not everybody is comfortable hitting that ignore button. But give some thought to what you want to do for a phone. Personally, I have an actual phone line, a dedicated phone line that rings in my office. That's the route that I wanted to go. That's going to run you probably $100 a month. But definitely, you need to get a phone. Email, very important. I think, as most of you know, most people today communicate via email. We get it on our phones, we get it on our computers, we get it all over the place. It's great. Give some thought, again, to the image that you want to project. Is a Gmail account serviceable? Absolutely. There's plenty of lawyers that, you know, willslawfirm@gmail.com. Nothing wrong with that. But again, from a credibility standpoint, and you'll see what I did, it's not a lot of money, and my email address is nathan@willsfirm.com. So it's got, you know, from my perspective, it lent a more credible image to my practice. Again, that doesn't cost a lot of money. When you're thinking about setting up your website, a lot of times you can package that together. So you can get your website, you can get your website hosting, and they'll often include like 10 email addresses as just part of the fee, so or part of the price point. So you can do your email address and however many other people you wanted to put there. I think when email first came out, and I was not practicing law when email first came out, the AOL, the Gmail, the whatever, the Hotmail, whatever the email of the time was fine. But as we have evolved as a profession, as you know, technology has evolved, I think more and more clients are going to expect you to have a professional sounding email address. I share space with a lawyer who's got an AOL address, and he's talked to me about it. He says, I should really change this. I said, yeah, you probably should. It was fine when AOL first came out, but things have evolved. And most of you are relatively young, relatively tech savvy, so I'm sure that that's something you're more than capable of taking care of. The next thing is snail mail. We actually, in practice, still use it a lot. So make sure you've got an actual mailing address. It can be a P.O. box. If you go that virtual office route, you can get your mailbox or your mail at the virtual office. Again, if you wanted to run everything strictly out of your home, that's an option. Personally, if I was going to run my office out of my home, I would want to put a P.O. box on my signature block. I wouldn't want to just use my home address. But you are absolutely going to receive mail, so give some thought to where do you want to receive that. Again, understanding that you're going to be broadcasting that out to potentially hundreds, if not thousands, of people. So what image do you want to present? What image do you want to portray on your mailing address? And lastly, the fax. I really don't like the fax machine at all. Why don't you just scan something and email it to me? You will run into people that don't know how to do that, and that will just say, can I fax this to you? And I always kind of scratch my head, really, that's the best way to do it? There are a lot of people that still want to do it. Lots of different things you can do with the fax. I know Microsoft Outlook has a program where you can receive faxes in your email inbox. That would be one route to go, but my point is simply that just because, and I include myself in this, just because you don't use the fax machine doesn't mean that nobody does. It is still somewhat prevalent or somewhat present in the practice of law, so you should probably have some way of receiving faxes. And then part and parcel with the mail, you're gonna send out letters as you're practicing. We still do a lot of stuff in writing, and writing is really our stock and trade. I mean, that's what we do, whether it's preparing a pleading or whether it's preparing a transactional document, a lease, whatever it is, we're reducing things to writing. So you're going to send actual hard copies of things to other lawyers, to clients. So you want to have some nice letterhead, some nice stationery. I'm not saying you have to go out and have a graphic designer design this beautiful piece of stationery, but again, a lot of it is about the image that you want to project for your office. You can certainly design your letterhead on your own, and there's a couple different ways you can do it. You can create it as a form in your word processing software, where you just take your letter and you drop it on there. Or you can go the old-fashioned way and actually have true letterhead stationery printed up. I know, you know, good-sized firms that do it both ways, so there's really no preference one way or the other. Again, from a perception standpoint, when your client picks up that piece of paper, what are they going to feel? What are they going to think about when they pick up that letter that you wrote them? You want it to be on heavier stock. You want it to feel professional. A couple ways you can do that: you can just print the letters, you know, right out of your email or out of your word processing program, and put the letterhead on there, but still do it on a heavier piece of paper. Or you can go out and actually get stationery. But give some thought to how you want your printed words to look and feel on the actual piece of paper.
Yeah, I'm sorry to take us back a few slides. But
sure, no, that's great.
Where do lawyers actually share space? Has there ever been an issue where there's a conflict?
Yes.
In terms of maybe clients and
sure.
You address?
And why do they share space?
No, what I mean is, is there a potential conflict where maybe some client may go for
okay. Sure. For those of you that didn't hear the question, and it was a good one, he was going back a couple steps about the space sharing issue, where maybe you've got 3, 4, 5 different lawyers, not in the same firm, all under the same roof. And that's a very important point. And his question was, you know, what about conflicts of interest? There's a couple things. You might want to include in your fee agreement, and that's actually spelled out in the rules of professional conduct, you might want to include something in writing that just says, I am not associated with anybody else. You know, it's just me, any people that I share space with, they're not my partners. Another thing that I do is when I meet with a client, I'll say, you saw the sign when you come in, there's two different names, two different law firms. He does his thing, I do mine. There can be a conflict of interest. If you're sharing space, but not in a partnership, you're really your own separate entity. So you could be representing somebody who is involved in litigation with the guy that sits next to you. And there you do get into some gray area. If you get into that situation, take a look at the ethical rules, look at the comments, research it so you don't get in any hot water. But that is absolutely something you need to be aware of, is if you do go into a space sharing arrangement, you want to talk to your clients, you know, from day one about the fact that you're not a partnership, you're not affiliated with these people. And then two, you know, if you have a client, you don't necessarily want to go through your client list with the people you're sharing space with, but certainly something to be aware of if the client is going to perceive it as a potential conflict. Great question. Any other questions? More tools of the trade. Computers. Everybody has them. Everybody uses them. Give some thought to how you want to practice. I would imagine that most, if not all of you, have laptops at this point. But you might want to think, do you want to have the desktop in your physical office? Do you want to have the laptop? I know with the advent of the iPad, lots of people are doing a lot of stuff on the iPad. I have one, but it's just not big enough, robust enough to totally run your practice off of. I think there's just going to run out of space. It's not going to work. So you're definitely going to need a computer. Give some thought to the laptop or the desktop option. And certainly that's going to be driven by how mobile you think you are. Do you like to work in a coffee shop? Do you like to be able to go to, you know, the law school and work on something, whatever it may be? But give some thought to what kind of computing you want to do. Do you want to go Apple? Do you want to go PC? Do you want to go Linux, for those of you that are really tech savvy? Lots of different ways you can go, but give some thought to what you want to do in terms of a computer. In terms of computing, electronic backup is absolutely, no question about it, a must. you need to do something to back up your file, you should get in the habit of doing it. Ideally, you should do it daily. You've probably seen commercials, I think, during the Super Bowl for Carbonite. There's lots of different ways you can do it. Dell has one that came with my computer when I bought it. I don't care how you do it, back your stuff up, because heaven forbid that you have that computer crash, you're gonna need to be able to recover those documents. So however you do it, you've got your computer, back it up. Ideally, that backup should be off-site, whether it's stored in the cloud or whether it's in a drive that you take home and keep somewhere else. However you do it, you need a way to back up your information. Another kind of hot topic is the paperless office, and I put that in quotes because as lawyers, there really is no way to absolutely entirely eliminate paper. That's what we do, we generate documents. But you can give some thought to reducing the amount of paper that you use. There are companies out there who will basically set you up to be a reduced paper office. You can take every piece of mail that you receive, scan it. Theoretically, you can then dispose of that piece of paper because you have it saved. And of course, you backed it up, so if anything should happen, you've got a couple copies of it, right? But if you want to go the paperless route, make sure you get a high-speed scanner. And there are companies out there in Cleveland who will do that for you. They'll get you the equipment, they'll get you the software so you can go and really reduce the amount of paper. The one, and my friend there left, the one thing I would caution you about there again, if you're going to do that, where all the paper that comes in you're not going to keep physical copies of, probably want to put that in your fee agreement with your client just so that they know that everything was stored electronically. Ethically, there's nothing wrong with doing that, but you want your clients to be informed so that they know, you know, they're not going to have the physical paper, but you can always, you know, get a copy of the file. Because if your client wants their file, they are absolutely entitled to it. So you want to make sure you have that copy in one form or another. And I would also urge you, if you want to go the paperless route, that's a great time to do it, is at the start of your practice. I've talked to people who have been in practice 5, 10, 15 years, and they're trying to convert everything to a digital practice, and it's a huge headache. So if you're going to do it, take the time to think about how you're going to do it from day one, rather than trying to do, you know, 20 years of records. And then lastly, a printer and a copier. Invest in a good, high-quality printer. Like I said, we generate documents. So you need to have something, you know, high quality where the print is going to come out nice. I know that sounds probably pretty elementary, but again, a lot of what I'm talking about is the perception that people have of you. So make sure the printed word that you create is going to look good for the people that are reading it. And then by the same token, you're going to need to duplicate things, so I would look into getting a high-quality copier as well. You can always go to a FedEx or a Kinko's or something like that, but that's going to get pretty pricey pretty quick. Kind of round the corner into the home stretch, talking about some kind of nitty-gritty stuff, financing and how you want to set it up. Give some thought to the business entity that you want to set up. Do you want to be a formal corporation? Do you want to be an LLC? Or do you want to just not have an entity? Any of those is fine. They're going to be different implications depending on which way you go. Obviously, the corporate structure is going to provide you with some level of insulation from a liability standpoint that you might want to think about. The LLC is going to provide some, but probably not as much. And then obviously, if it's just you, you can do that, but there's really no corporation that you're, you know, that you're setting up. So give some thought to doing that. You know, file the appropriate documents with the Secretary of State, those kinds of issues.
Yeah. Why did you go with the LLC?
I didn't want to go the route of the huge corporate structure, but I wanted to create something that was a separate entity. I'm a solo practitioner, so from a tax standpoint, it's all on a pass-through taxation basis. But I wanted it gave me a little bit of insulation. Beyond that, I don't really have a good answer. It felt right to me. I didn't just want to be me.
But do you think you get as many tax benefits as if you were a corporation or more?
You're the tax guy. Honestly, I would probably have more from a tax standpoint. It might be better to go the full, you know, the corporate route. It wasn't something I wanted to do right off the bat, but that's a great question from a tax standpoint. Think about it. If you're a tax lawyer, you should have a pretty good handle on that. If, like me, you're not, talk to your CPA. But those are all that's what you want to think about in terms of setting up your business structure. The other thing you're going to want to think about is dealing with banks. Certainly you're going to need a business banking account available from pretty much any bank. You're also probably going to need an IOLTA when those clients pay you. You haven't earned that money yet, so you need to keep it in your trust fund. And then lastly, you want some kind of credit card. You know, you're taking a client out or a potential referral source out. You want to be able to buy them lunch or dinner. You need to be able to do that, not on your wife's dime. And then lastly, a line of credit. Again, if when you get into those lead months, you want to have something that you can use to kind of get you through. If you're doing a lot of personal injury work and you need to finance some cases, you might not always have that in the bank. It's just kind of a cushion, something to have. You're not necessarily going to get approved for it right off the bat, but it's certainly something to think about.
Nathan, can you advise them how much money you would suggest they need going in? I mean, I'm assuming they can't go in with a zero bank account. I mean,
standpoint or just to open up
kind
a
of
business?
To get them started, how much money should they have in their back pocket?
The conventional wisdom is that you should have six to 12 months of your living expenses saved up, you know, so that you can keep the lights on and keep a roof over your head. And then in terms of your business, there's gonna be some certain startup costs that you're gonna need. And I think a lot of that, to your question, is gonna be driven by how big, how robust of a practice do you wanna set up? How much are you gonna spend on rent every month? How much are you gonna spend on developing your website, getting your stationery, those kinds of things. So to back yourself into it, look through all of those items and kind of figure out how much is this gonna cost to get me off the ground. I think that would be a good place to start. Managing your cash flow, you're gonna have money coming in, you're gonna have money going out. First, like I said, unless you're the tax guy, I would talk to an accountant to talk about the tax implications. Do you wanna go an S corp? Do you wanna go LLC? Do you want to just be a sole practitioner? Also give some thought to what kind of accounting software you wanna use. Peachtree is one, QuickBooks is another. And then some of the practice management software like Amicus and Time Matters have some accounting functionality built into it. But you're going to need to be able to track, you know, what's coming in, what's going out. And then at the end of the year, you're going to need to be able to recover all of that and summarize it so you can pay your taxes. A couple more things that I wanted to address, and then I'll let everybody get going. Legal research. As law students, you have access to a whole bunch of stuff that you just don't have when you're practicing. You can't get all of those cases from every single state when you have to actually pay for it. The bar associations offer some really high quality research tools with your membership. Cleveland Bar Association uses FastCase. Ohio State Bar Association uses CaseMaker. All of those are functional resource tool or legal research tools. If you haven't checked either of those out, take a look at them now so you can kind of compare them to what you have via Lexis or Westlaw. If you find that that's going to be adequate, that's great. By the same token, if you feel like you need something more robust, take a look at a Lexis or a Westlaw or something that you're going to have to pay for. There are a lot of options out there. Across from the Justice Center is the old courthouse, and on the top floor of the old courthouse is a law library. You can consider joining that. They give you access, and there's a membership fee to join, but they give you access to Lexis and Westlaw through there, and they also have a bunch of books that you can research in as well. You can always come here. Yeah.
Do you have to access it from the live?
You don't?
You can do some.
You
like
can
you
do
can
some.
Get like Ogier.
Okay.
Like online, but
okay.
It's a little backwards the way you have to do it.
Okay. There you go. So you actually can access it from off-site to a certain extent. And then you can always, I think, come back to the law school and see what is available here. Certainly at that point, you're probably not going to be able to get into some of the online resources. But in terms of the books, you can look at what's available in the law school library. Last couple of things, you do want to protect yourself. A couple of insurance policies you want to get. You want to get a general corporate or a commercial general liability policy. Somebody comes, and that's assuming you have a brick and mortar office. Somebody comes into your office, they trip, they fall, they get hurt. You can potentially have a claim against you. So you want to have some kind of insurance coverage there. And then secondly, and probably more importantly, you want to have some type of professional liability coverage. If you do not, you're not required to. If you do not have professional liability coverage, you need to tell your clients that from the outset. And I would just recommend having it for peace of mind. And there's lots of different companies, lots of different places that you can purchase professional liability insurance. I think the minimum recommended is $100,000 per claim, but you can get, you know, as big a policy as you want. And like I said, if you don't have one, you need to disclose that to your clients. And like I said, the general liability insurance policy, the general liability insurance policy as well. And then really the last thing that I wanted to talk about is from a planning standpoint. When we start out on a trip, we know where we want to go. You can't just open your law firm and see what happens. Give some thought to where you want to end up. Where do you want to be in a year? Where do you want to be in 2 years? Where do you want to be in 5 years? Give yourself a little bit of a roadmap. Don't get intimidated by the term business plan. It doesn't need to be a 25-page document with multicolored graphs and pullouts and all this other stuff. Business plan simply means I have a destination in mind. This is how I want to get there. Think about your marketing. Think about where you're going to generate clients. What type of clients do you want? What are your anticipated revenues the first year, the second year, so on and so forth. Give yourself some idea of where you're starting from, where you want to end up, and specifically how you're going to meet your goals. Also, if you're going to try and get a loan, like a small business association loan or something like that, they're probably going to require some type of written business plan with some degree of formality. If you're not going to try and get a loan, you're not going to necessarily need as robust of a plan, but definitely give some thought to how you want to achieve the objectives that you have set out. And I think that's it. The last couple of things, and these are things that I found really helpful. This guy named Jay Foonberg has a book. It's a huge book, How to Start and Build a Law Practice. Check it out. It's here. It's available in this library. I took it. I read it, and it's just got a lot of really good suggestions about a lot of the stuff that we talked about. How do you get this off the ground? And then if you want to look at something on the web, on the internet, I think the site is still up. It's myshingle.com, as in you're hanging a shingle. Carolyn Elephant has done a lot of this kind of stuff. She's got blogs talking about being a solo practitioner, how to open the practice. That's another resource, and I think from her website, and she's got some links to some other folks as well. So if you're looking for more information, those are a couple of resources to check out. That concludes the formal portion of my presentation. I did give all of you my business cards, and like I said at the outset, if you have questions, comments, concerns, thoughts, something that you want to ask me about, don't hesitate to send me an email, give me a call. Like I said, if you call me at 2 a.m., I'm not going to answer the phone. If you do call, leave a message, and I'll be more than happy to get back to you. Other than that, I just wanted to thank you for the opportunity to be here. I can stick around for a couple minutes if you folks have questions. And like I said, I'd certainly be more than happy to answer them. So, thank you.
And while I still have the majority here, I also wanted to introduce Tom Heron, who is a 2011 grad who also has successfully opened a practice. And he's also, lucky for us, the new chair of the solo section of the CMBA. Do you want to say a couple things about that?
Sure. Jen said, I sit on some of the same things that Nathan does. So I'm involved with the incubator and the solo and small firm task force. I'm the chair of the solo and small firm subcommittee of the Bar Association. So I'm trying to work as closely as I can with our subcommittee, with the Bar Association. There's a special place in my heart for all of you because I was in the same situation. I'd scared out of my mind. So I have cards there. Give me a call, shoot me an email. We'd like to get you, from the Bar Association standpoint, involved in the Bar Association as much as we can. The CMBA is really making a push towards solo and small firms. Recently, because of basically what's happening with the legal market, there's a big transition back towards the solo and small firm practice model. So I'd love to get to know a little, I know a couple of you guys already, so I'd love to get to know a little bit more about you and different ways that we can be involved in your practices and ways that we can help you guys grow some successful businesses. So
thank you so much. Thank you so much, Nathan.
Thank you.
Great presentation.